So my name is Eric Simon, and I just spent, well, from September 2017 up until June 2021, I spent 4 years in London. So during the COVID and lockdown period, and with all the legal requirements regarding masks and vaccination and track and trace and all these things. And I had to, I don't know if I can say that live, but I had to leave France because, how can I say, the French state happened not to stick to legal decisions regarding me against the state. So I had no option but avoiding my money and my dollars being taken illegally by the state because they refused to stick to legal decisions. So I had to leave. I had to leave France. So that's why I went to the UK.
I mean, everyone likes to think that their earnings and their wealth are fairly sacred once they're there and they're sitting in a bank, that the state can't just come along and take them.
Well, the thing is, I've been involved in quite a few things like, I don't know if you can call that whistleblower, but I kind of, it's not easy to explain, but I kind of said things to people, and notably this one was to someone I knew in Interpol, and in Lyon, you know, Interpol, you know what it's like, what it is, and it seems like my life was turned upside down out of the blue, and that's really correct. And even at some point they attacked me, they attacked my son, okay, because I just reported, so I'm not going to go into details into that.
So I mean, what you're saying really is that you've reported something to the authorities, in this case the law enforcement people, and you found yourself kind of slapped about as a result.
Absolutely. It was just simply warning. One guy I knew was about to leave Lyon, Interpol, to go in the Southeast Asia. And I said to him, I said, you should keep an eye on that NGO related to children and children working in mines, because the guy who founded this NGO is a sentenced paedophile twice, and he's linked to the French judiciary. And, well, I think it's bizarre. I mean, it allows a ton of people to have charities dealing with kids, and especially in these areas like Thailand or Bangladesh and all these places, you know, where paedophile, how can I say, gangs or rings or trafficking kind of rife. So from that point on, I started, my life was turned upside down. I got sacked immediately. And the state attacked me related to supposedly money I was not entitled to get when I had been on the boat. That's when I beat the state team on the Court of Appeal. And two weeks later, I received the start of a new procedure from the first instance or the district tribunal, but absolutely destroyed by the Court of Appeal later. So in no way, not the state, nor the district tribunal, I think, were allowed to start the same procedure again. So that's why I had to leave, because when you're up to this point, there's no point for you to stay in this country, you know.
So can you just bring us up to date with what's been going on? We've heard a little bit here in the UK that they've been a bit shy of reporting exactly what's going on in France, partly because of the King's visit, which had to be cancelled, and partly because I suppose they don't want the British to get ideas, because we've had an amazing set of events around these pension reforms, which have gone through here in Britain without so much as a whisper almost, and yet in France the people have decided through the parliament, etc., to make a big fuss about it. In fact, Macron has had to start ruling by decree effectively. So can you just tell us a bit about what's been going on with these pension protests?
Well, first of all, about what you referred to last, about Macron ruling by decree. It's been a trend ever since he took over in 2017. So it's been what we call ordinances, you know, which is about nearly the same as decree. And so it's decreed as well, executive orders. And recently, for the 10th time, he used some kind of legal shenanigan, you know, which is called the Article 49.3, which is that, in fact, whenever the Parliament wants it or not, a vote against one proposed regulation by the government has the right for the kind of a public good to push it through anyway. So this doesn't... It sounds a bit like democracy, according to the EU, in fact, you know, and all these...
What I can't understand is how can it be for the public good to force people to work for an extra 2 years? I mean, that isn't really helping people at all.
No, it is not, but it is one part of the French law, you know. So they just simply use it. But you know what? It's not the first time one government, whatever the side, it could be the Socialist Party or the more centre-right one, they've all used it at least once. So none of these political parties can actually say something really about it because they've been through the same, you know, they pushed some regulation exactly the same. It has to be said, as you know, because you did the right thing in the UK, you did Brexited, you know, but you know that while the... when the EU say this is one direction you have to take, then all these regulations have to be implemented in local, in national parliaments within 2 years. And it's been long wished by the European Union that the kind of, you know, pension scheme in France should be changed, you know. And I think that's, you know, absolutely unfair because what people realise is that year after year, you know, it's always put the blame on the people, okay, for them to have to be so kind of a privilege, when in fact they are losing all what has been acquired and implemented right after the Second World War by De Gaulle, notably his government, which was a mix of communist and centre-right people, you know, from the resistance. And for instance, Sarkozy... people like big bosses and big corporations and big money people who helped Sarkozy to take over in 2007 said Sarkozy has one job, to take everything that has been achieved by the what we call in France the CNR, which is the Resistance National Council, who during Second World War, with even during the war, established a new kind of a political view, which looks a bit like what you have done as well in the UK, you know, with, what's his name, Bevan, you know, the guy that made the NHS in the UK. So we had the social security, we had the unemployment scheme, and the pension scheme. So that's the three big achievements right after the Second World War. And it seems that Sarkozy's job was to get rid of this. Plus, you've got the... you know, the EU that is pushing for this as well, you know, some kind of a hidden privatization slowly, bit by bit, by making it look not good at all, you know, and not sufficient enough to have people to make a living when they go to retirement. But the thing is, a lot of the people are fully aware of why the system is not sustainable because there's a lack of money coming in, because they are claiming that there's not enough people, you know, paying for the pension regarding people who are getting the pension. But the problem is not the people's problem, you know, it's the regulations problem. And if we are reaching up to this point, if the government hasn't got that much money at the moment, we should look into the policies that brought this situation, and not blaming the people for this situation. And that's been the trend of any government, one after the other, just to put the blame on the people. It's the people's fault because they've got their privilege, you know. And that's a big lie.
Well, that's quite right. But look, I mean, why is it, do you think, in France that we get such a big response out on the streets? That sort of thing doesn't happen in many countries, does it? Very rare. But in France, there seems to be, you know, people seem to be more politicized, Eric.
I am not quite so sure, really, because that's what you see from the outside. But when you look around you, it's just, it's, you know, I wouldn't say there's a big percentage, but this very percentage is quite very active. And if you take it, considering the what happened in 2018 and then 2019 with the yellow jacket or the yellow vest, the physiognomy is quite different, because this time you've got the unions that are coming in, and a lot of these unions, notably the main one in France, which is called the CGT, which has a lot of, I mean, double, very politicized member of the union whose political background are linked to the far left. Okay, and these people, whenever they're still not very powerful, if you look at the polls or the election results, they're still very active, very organized, and they can move quite a lot of people for, you know, what a lot of French people really believe that it is their thing, you know, the pension scheme, Sécurité sociale, the social security, like the NHS that you got, and, you know, in the poor state as well in the UK. So it's a very, it's still held dearly by the French people, and they don't want to lose this, you know. And plus, there's a lot of people upset by the fact that Macron says, well, you know, the whole pension system lacks 14 billion. If you look how much they spent on vaccines, if you look how much they spent on the tax exemptions, you know, there's tax exemption laws coming on government after government. And this only, I remember during the left, the socialist period, you know, from 2012 to 2017, the one in which Macron was a finance minister and then he became president. So under socialist president Hollande, the French government gave something like 140 billion maybe a year in tax exemption, which just went straight into the big mega corporations shareholders' pockets, you know. So we fall over the so-called 12 billion missing. Plus, there is something very interesting that it is not mentioned, is that time after time, the government tried to change the very, how can I say, core of the pension scheme system. It has to be understood that the state doesn't run the pension scheme. It is run both by unions, so it's a representative of workers. They call it partenaires sociaux, social partners, okay, which are unions and representative of employers, because both sides, it could be employers and employees, contribute to the pension scheme pot, okay? So it is dealt by them and not by the state. And for a long time, because it represents a lot of money from the employers and the employees, it's their own till. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying. But the state tried to bring this pot into the national budget accountancy, in the government budget accountancy, and to steer it away from what they call the social partners, which are employers and employees contributing in the same pot. Okay, it seems like they want to steal that money, probably to ease up a bit of the absolute outrageous public debt that has reached probably something like in France like 150% of GDP. Okay, I don't know if it's very clear what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
A lot of people are absolutely upset because they know that the money is there. If I can add to this one, I think it was back in I don't know. I think it was made under Sarkozy, I think. There's been a law allowing, I can say, French or multinational corporations established in France to open a branch in Barbados or in, you know, in tax haven, you know, like the British Virgin Island or wherever, Switzerland. And they were allowed to relocate, I would say, any, you know, earnings from the company or benefit, not benefit, that's not the word in English, but income or, you know, all the money that's been earned by a company into one of these tax havens and pay absolutely no tax in France. So indeed, it was some kind of a tax exemption, and all these big corporations who can avoid, how can I say, fiscal lawyers, you know, put their money in there and paid absolutely no taxes in France. So, you know, that's something that a lot of people are aware.
Now, there's one similarity right across the channel, and that is that we've now got people from what we used to call the merchant banks, the finance capitalists, in the driving seat. So, you know, in Macron, he used to work for the Rothschilds, and Rishi Sunak for Goldman Sachs, Eric.
Yes. Well, I think that's typical of the World Economic Forum leaders that we are seeing now. You know, it's that kind of people with the, we say that they've got teeth down to the ground, you know, like that's what we're saying. These are kind of sharks, you know, they don't care about the people. They're just here to please the shareholders of these big corporations, of these internationalist bankers, you know. So this is why the world looks what it looks like at the moment, you know, remembering that when Rothschild, and this is especially in accordance to what happened during the COVID era, when Macron was working at the Rothschild Bank, he was in charge of the, how can I say, the Pfizer portfolio. His direct client was Pfizer. So, you know, of course, you know, he made everything he could to please his previous customers, I guess. But Macron has one duty, is to increase massively the public debt. So all these banks living off the public debt. And that's another reason a lot of French people start to get more and more aware of how the money creation system works. I hope so. But I know among my yellow jacket friends that they are fully aware of how the system works. I would like to say something about the difference in between what happened during the Yellow Jacket movement and now the pension scheme. During the Yellow Jacket movement, it was really a grassroots movement. You could have left, right, retired people, small business owner, anybody. That's what really scared. And there was no leaders, just like there is now, which are unions. The government, at some point, needs, in some way, the unions. Because unions, it's a big structure. It's not just like the Yellow Jacket movement that was coming out of nowhere. And you could not direct, you know, at the beginning. Because later, they tricked this movement. But during the Yellow Jacket movement, unions were nowhere to be seen. Nowhere to be seen. If the unions had worked with the Yellow Jacket, then something much bigger could have been achieved. But I suspect, and especially regarding to my own experience, because I've been a representative of workers, I've been an elected representative of workers, and I've been designated as well by the CGT that we just mentioned, which is the biggest union in France. Probably the best in some way, because the other ones are becoming like really useless and pointless. But so I can tell you, you can believe my word, Tony, that sometimes the CGT, even CGT, could help the government get away with this. And that's why they did not join. I believe that they did not join the Yellow Jacket movement. And, you know, I'm very bitter about this, very bitter.
Well, one thing you can do, I think, to, kind of make sure this kind of thing, it doesn't happen so often or doesn't happen again, even maybe, is to explain how you think the Yellow Jacket movement was tricked.
It was tricked in a very simple way. At the beginning, for instance, the Yellow Jacket was grassroots movement. So anybody who had reasons to complain were out on the streets. If you take, for instance, small business owners, okay, all these people had to bear the tax exemptions that were made for the big corporations. So they became the target of heavy and heavily handed taxations. You know, they had the income tax inspectors, I would say, on and on and on and on, you know, to steer any or to, you know, get any nickel out of them, you know. So they were very fed up because it seems like, because the tax exemption, all the burden of the taxation was on their shoulder and on the shoulders of the working class people. Not the people who were on benefits, but the working class people and the small business owners are really the core of the people paying and, how can I say, sustaining the system. So they were out on the streets. But very soon you had the infiltrators. So at the beginning, the Yellow Jacket movement had no leaders. So that was one good thing, because it could not be infiltrated and taken over. But at the same time, the Yellow Jacket movement lacked some direction. There was no, you know, unlike a few of the friends we were talking about in a previous conversation, like the Gilets Jaunes Constituant, which had a constitution and a plan and a political plan to come after, let's say, one revolution. Okay, one was to implement a direct referendum that could be triggered by citizens themselves if they wanted a law to be implemented, or if they wanted one supposed elected leader be removed at any point, not to be waiting another 5 years before they vote again. It triggered this during the guy's mandate. But anyway, that was one of the things. And so what they did, like, there was a lack of leaders. So the media invented leaders. And all the protests in France were not, how can I say it, previously, before they happened, declared to the administration or the police. And then this happened because these so-called leaders that came out of the blue, made by the media, put on the TV, like, that's your leaders, started to declare the protest. So what happened then is, like, all the process, like, you could say, imagine from Trafalgar Square to Hyde Park, like it happened during the COVID protest. I was on the front line. I've seen me on Trafalgar Square, in front of the police cordon on Trafalgar Square, when they tried to arrest, I think, Jeremy Corbyn. The news came out that they were about to arrest Jeremy Corbyn. So plenty of us, like many guys, went up on the stairs just near the, I think it's the National Gallery, and to protect Jeremy Corbyn. But he was gone already. That was good. Not Jeremy Corbyn, but his brother, Piers Corbyn. So what was I saying? So then the media, the French media, invented these leaders who declared the protest. You know, the protest, the way it was going through Paris. So what the police did, and Macron did, is like they blocked the protest from the beginning till the end, okay, and all the adjacent streets, okay. And at some point, they did not allow people to leave whenever they were asking people to leave or telling people to leave. So people were trying to leave from one way or another, and they were blocked. And when they were blocked, they were told to go back and use the other exit. And when they reached the other exit, it was blocked again. So you started to have people trapped within what we call the NAS, you know, in some kind of a net. And then the coppers started to shoot the tear gas. So, of course, what happened, it stirred violence. And at that moment, the police allowed the infiltrators, that they call the Black Bloc, or the so-called Antifa, which has all the tactics and the manners of the fascist, really, okay, who came in, and exactly on the point that they came in and they started to destroy shops, advertising or, you know, cars and this, breaking windows and all these things. And it happened exactly on the buildings on which on top of these buildings, you had all the medias filming all the what was happening, you know, the breaking of the windows, the fight with the police and all. So time after time, people got scared about joining in the protest, you know, and you started to hear these chants like anti-capitalist and, you know, you're not going to bring one small business owner who, sorry, I don't want to be rude, but who works his arse off, if I can say, okay, all day long, to walk along these guys who are kind of extremist in some ways, you know, arguing about the police and anti-capitalist and all this. So it kind of divided the movement. It split it in two, the far left and the right. Okay, the central right, like the working class people, but who are not on the far right. So it divided then the movement like this. And even within the movement, people start to fight each other. Okay? One calling the other one like extremist and calling the other one fascist.
I mean, the thing is, because the Yellow Jackets were such a broad coalition, wasn't that bound to happen anyway?
It's, yes. But it could have been dealt intelligently, you know. It's but that division has been steered purposely on every side, on the right side and on the left side. So I think it's been made by infiltrators, because at the beginning, I don't think that this big division was a big issue within the Yellow Jacket movement. It was probably about to happen, but it could have been dealt much better than that. If you look at what constituted the French resistance during the Second World War, and the one that for 2 years, from 1945 to end of 1946, what built what remains today of the French social service social system has been built at that time by General de Gaulle and the communists. They worked together. One was kind of traditionalist, was conservative, very Christian. The Gerard de Gaulle was very Catholic, and you know, it was a big part of his personality and his person. And at the same time, you had the communists as well, and they worked together to build what we still have today. So this could have been dealt from the start very intelligently, I hope, in the future. That is why I put the blame a little bit on the unions and on the left, because they purposely did not, you know, partake in the Yellow Jacket movement, you know, as a body. And from that moment on, the Yellow Jacket started to be very suspicious when it came to union. So
anyway, what do you reckon to Macron's future now?
You know, he showed so much disrespect to what people think, to humans, just, you know, simply as people, you know, during the COVID, during, you know, even still now with the war on, you know, the war in Ukraine, you know, lies after lies. If you look what he's done to sell, like, the family jewels in France for American corporation, like, you know, Alstom, I don't know if you know about this, you know. And it seems like he doesn't really care. I think.
Tell us a bit about that.
I think that he just don't care. I think he's going to carry on up until the point where he feels like the situation is going to get very, you know, dramatic. I think like he's on the verge to be literally seized by the people, or just arrested by the people, which. That could happen at some point, but
it looks from across the channel, it looks like it might be deliberate brinksmanship. So he's pushing people as far as they'll go until they snap.
It could be. Maybe they're expecting something, you know. I don't know. There's so many scenarios. I think we should always keep an eye as well on what's happening in Ukraine. Because imagine, would there be a main chaos happening in Ukraine? Then he could call for some kind of, extraordinary power. You know, get rid of the protest against the Macron's reform on the pension scheme. He could dissolve the parliament as well, because he hasn't got any majority at the parliament, so he cannot rule by himself. He always needs one. Luckily enough, so far it seems like he's always found all the left, all the centre right, to allow his reform to go through. You know, so that's exactly what happened when he avoided destitution, when his government avoided the vote of no confidence recently by just 9 votes. And this time it's been the centre-right. Sometimes some motion or some regulation are proposed by the Le Pen party, which is, let's say, right or far-right, as some people say. And it's been defeated any time by the left. Okay, and Macron added to the left side. So it seems like it's just a silly game, okay, that these political parties, for their own interest, play, not in the in the common interest of the French people. And this point is very crucial, because it seems like, due to this ongoing division in between the left and the right, it seems like the bad things are happening and are going through just because of this division. And you know what? This is exactly the very thing against which General de Gaulle was fighting against. He said, I am before the war and after the war. He said, I'm absolutely fed up about these people just thinking about their own cuisine, you know, their own cooking, you know, as we say in France, and not bothering about the common interest and about the nation. So that's why, you know, he was very much up against this. And you know what? We are seeing exactly the same right now. Absolutely.
Is there any salvation for France? Do you think there's any serious candidates up there that could sweep Macron aside?
No, I don't. I don't think that any change is going to happen through this political system. Absolutely not. It's rigged, Tony. Rigged from exactly like in the UK. It will come from one providential people, just like General de Gaulle was. And General de Gaulle was kind of muffled, damp, deep in, because General de Gaulle, from the early 1930s, as soon as Hitler arrived, he said, well, we should be doing this, we should rearm, we should not let Germany do this. So when Germany invaded the Ruhr, I don't know how you call that, the Ruhr, R-H-U-R, you know, the Renani, I think that's the word. General de Gaulle at the time, he was literally unknown, he was just a colonel. He said, we should stop them right now, not later, now, because otherwise it's going to kick off again. So, but he's been kept aside. And I think that at the moment, there's nobody rigged. Okay, this system is made for other people, other powers to get control, but not the people.
Yeah, I think you're right. Finally, what about King Charles? Because he was due to come to France. Apparently not now, but he's just gone, skipped straight to Berlin today.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, probably that's very symptomatic that he chose Berlin instead of Paris, okay, regarding his family history. But no disrespect to the Queen. I like the Queen personally very much, very much. I think she was a decent person. I wouldn't say exactly the same about the whole family, but I very much love the Queen personally. And I think that it was very not much the time for a monarch to come into Paris at this time, especially because of the kind of heavy protests all over France. And at the same time as well, you know, the garbage are not collected, you know, the bins and the garbage are not collected. So at the moment, Paris is very, very dirty. You've got rubbish everywhere. Okay, so it's not quite a vision to host the King of England, I guess. So it was not very well welcome. And how can I say this? I think that this visit was not very timely. Can I say timely? Can I say convenient? It was not the right convenient time at all. And
So just to round up, Eric, can you point people towards what you think are good places to look online for news?
What do you mean, in France?
Well, anywhere really. I mean, I suppose this is in the English language I'm talking about. I mean,
I think your program I've
followed for a long time is called the Voltaire Network, which seems pretty good.
The Voltaire Network. Yes, you got Thierry Messon, I think it is. I am not, I'm doing my own research now, so I just do not have one in name right now. The Réseau Voltaire is one good one of Thierry Messon. It's been on for a long time. Réseau Voltaire then, and what can I say? There is one in France which has an amazing insightful about Zionist shenanigans in France. And it's a website, it may well be in English as well. It's called Panamza, P-A-N-M-Z-A. Okay, Panamza. And this guy, for whoever is a French-speaking person in England, you can be very surprised by all the insight he has about the Zionist connection within French politics. And he's got amazing information about relation between the so-called, Bataclan or the Charlie Hebdo terrorist and the Mossad. Okay, and even some people within French politics related to both Sarkozy and ex-French Prime Minister Manuel Valls, which is an utter Zionist, just like Sarkozy, by the way. So,
well, I mean, one person that seems to have done quite a lot of work, a Frenchman, I believe, is this guy Laurent Gianneau, I was watching recently his documentary about the Kennedy brothers, the assassination of the Kennedy brothers, and he's suggesting that the Israelis were very much involved in the Kennedy assassination and have been, you know, really steering much of Western politics for a while with the odd assassination and with a lot of influence.
Of course, the Zionists are. But first of all, I think that the Kennedy didn't want the Israelis to get the nuclear weapons. But I think that's beyond. I think there was a conjunction of so many interests to kill Kennedy. It could be the mafia. It could be Lyndon Johnson. It could have been Israel. But I think on top of them. And on top of Israel, indeed, you've got the Rothschild, because JFK, I don't know if this guy mentioned this, I'm writing a book and I mentioned this as well, but if you look at Executive Order 11,110, if I recall well, in which actually the Kennedy banned the Federal Reserve from the money creation monopoly. So he took back the ultimate power of the deep state, you know, financial internationalist deep state, to create money out of nothing. And I think that was the thing that those big bankers, and I think the Rothschild first, could not allow to happen. Okay? I think that's simple as this. We know, you know very well how the system works and how the money creation system is controlled and who controls it. Through other names like J.P. Morgan or the Rockefellers or whatever, you know, it's the same dynasty. Okay, so
interesting. I mean, we almost come full circle back to Macron again, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. You know, and you know, related to the public debt, the more there is, the richer these people are.
The poorer the whole of the country is, and you know, getting people into a debt trap, we all know how that works. You know, you just get people into debt and then you become the master, they become the slave.
Absolutely. I've been researching an NGO in France, which is actually dealing supposedly to be, and it's got the agreement from the United Nations to be the representative of ex-Blue Helmets, you know, the soldiers of peace of the UN, you know, the Blue Helmets. You know what it's like, you know what it is, the Blue Helmets.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. So there's an international NGO, supposedly of 55,000 members, okay, which is based in Lyon. And actually, when you start to investigate the people who are start to supply them in France, okay, you've got a simple company, for instance, one. But when you start to dig deep in behind these so-called small companies who are giving them bandages and all these things that they supply or ship to Ukraine and all, you start to find top-level Israeli interest in oil and gas, in the banking industry, in the, in the genetics, in all sorts, and even the Israeli aerospace and Israeli military interests, whatever. So I found that absolutely fascinating. It's a small company of 50 people in France, but when you look at the people on their board, you see nothing in France, just this company. If you look on international matter, it's kind of clicking Israel everywhere. But top level, and even what, you know what, the Bronfman family. Bronfman, you know, does it ring a bell? Bronfman, they are the people behind Epstein. They are the people behind the, Nexium. Remember Nexium? This guy, Keith Raniere, that made a pedophile kind of a sect with, I'm pretty sure, maybe I do not pronounce it right. So, okay. So I'm deep inside the NGO, and I do believe behind this NGO in France, you have companies like Sanofi. It's hidden, it's remote, but you have Sanofi. You've got, in Sanofi, you've got the guy who took Macron to Rothschild. So this NGO is potentially the heart of the international soft power linked to the World Health Organization and the UN, okay? And they're getting utterly active in Lebanon, thanks to the explosion of the Beirut port. They're active in Belarus, and they're active in Ukraine. And behind these companies, you've got deep technology related to Sanofi, L'Oreal, Nestle, BASF, the German giant, which was part of IG Farben during the Second World War. And you've got Danone, that food and beverage company in France, which is a mega corporation. And you've got all that. And you've got the Pasteur Institute, which is Sanofi, okay? Pasteur Institute being the one very much involved with COVID thing. So this is huge. I've found things that have anything to hide to make, for instance, Captagon and sell it in Lebanon or for Daesh in Syria or whatever. And it's a bit, I've made videos about that in France. So some of them, the whole thing for the moment lasts something like 7 hours. In 7 different videos, but I shall send you more detail, especially about their connections in Lebanon. And believe me, these connections behind the scenes go up until the very inner circle in Macron, okay? Go with people in security in Lebanon, Belarus, and Ukraine, okay? They're dealing with pregnant women in Ukraine. They're dealing with a company linked to L'Oreal, which could hide some kind of bioweapons, because L'Oreal has some research center related to toxic liquid that could reach the skin and that could infect straight the intestine and all these things. They're working on that. And that's the kind of company which is supplying material to that NGO dealing with the United Nations Blue Helmet, supposedly, and shipping all these things in Lebanon, in Belarus, and in Belarus, and in Ukraine.
So, are we talking about something like the White Helmets or not?
It could potentially be a relation to White Helmets in Syria through Lebanon. Because I do suspect, and guess what? One of the companies linked to the Lebanese side of this web, okay, is a security company who's got charge of nuclear sites in France. So if it's a Mossad operation, and I believe this is a Mossad operation, they have the ability potentially to sneak out nuclear material out of French nuclear sites because they are dealing with the security. And guess what? They're dealing with the security, the nuclear site near Dijon in Burgundy, in which, due to the Lancaster Treaty between Sarkozy and Cameron, the nuclear material is stored. And this, you know, it happens. I started to make videos about that.
Eric Simon, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tony.